and it's called BBS. And this was started in 1966, and basically in response to exactly the kind of thing that Julie was talking about. In the 1950s and 1960s, we were using a number of very toxic chemicals in a very regular way, one of them being DDT. And it was found that DDT affected the calcium production of a number of bird species, and most notably was the bald eagle. That's the one people hooked on to as our national symbol. But other species, such as pelicans, cormorants, peregrine falcons, and there's a much longer list. And it was noted actually by one person who was working on eagles and was climbing into their nests to band young, and he was finding these very thin shelled eggs, eggs that were laid with no shell at all, and he began to report it. And as a result of that, people began looking at population trends and monitoring the birds. Well, Fish and Wildlife Service, after this happened and they found out about all these other species, so osprey is another example, that had been affected and were declining in number. Fish and Wildlife Service was, I don't know, shocked, embarrassed. They had no way of knowing, no way of measuring population changes. And that led them to institute this breeding bird survey, which goes on every June, and they have a very extensive team of people throughout the country, primarily volunteers. Some are professional people who are paid to go out and run these survey routes, but they're particular specific survey routes that are randomly located throughout the U.S. and North America. And people go and do a very similar thing as to what you did, follow a particular route and record everything they see and hear in a certain time block. And then all this information goes back to Fish and Wildlife Service, and they put it into a big computer database. So they now, starting in 1966, are equipped to do this kind of monitoring. So we've got the monitoring of habitat changes that Carrie talked about. We've got this big scale kind of monitoring to identify population changes before it's too late, or at a time when people can track back to when the decline occurred. And initially it was in response to DDT, but it can be in response to anything. Any other reasons that monitoring or knowing how many numbers there are is important? Well, simply from a basic science question of how over time do population changes occur, and you're going to have changes occur naturally. You're going to have a lot of factors other than toxic chemicals that may affect bird populations. People are very interested in, are birds responding to climate change? Climate changes, temperature increases, decreases, whatever the case may be. It's a good way of monitoring maybe single species or a handful of species. There's been a lot of concern about forest bird numbers in relation to practices by the timber industry, for example. You may have an endangered species you want to monitor. I do a census type, not like what you did, but we census every year for piping plovers. There may be basically kind of an aesthetic reason for knowing what is there. If you were hired by a park, national park, state park, as an ornithologist or as a vertebrate biologist, most parks have bird lists, but a lot of places don't, especially if you got in on a new park. Often one of the first assignments for people who are in the Peace Corps and have a job in a national park is to go out and make a list. What's out there? So some of these techniques I'm going to talk about will give you the skills, or at least the knowledge, to know how to go about doing this. And the method we used this morning is one. If you have a huge area and you want to be able to sample it, want to have an idea of what's out there, you need to have some kind of a technique. Every time we go out on a field trip, we, in a sense, we walk a transect. We don't have these spot locations where we stop, specific locations, points. But we walk a transect and we record everything that we see and hear. One visit, we may not have a very good picture. We've got kind of a little glimpse. If you do it over a 10-year time period, it gets to be better and better. Or if you do it multiple times during one season. So the question of why census, I think we've covered. And the kinds of questions that you ask, the typical questions are, how many individuals, how many different species? There are a lot of other kinds of questions that you could be asking, especially if you're collecting information over time. Okay, the next thing that I want to ask you, when you were out there and you were collecting the data, there were probably a lot of things that went through your mind about, you know, am I doing a good job here? Is this accurate? What were the kinds of things you worried about, or what are the things that you can think of right now that may not have given you as accurate a picture as you wanted of what the bird community is? Let's say that the assignment, let's say you're employed here all year round, and your assignment was to determine species diversity and abundance at two sites. You went out today. What was good about what you did today, and what doesn't answer that assignment or doesn't complete the assignment? Okay. Cassie.
Because maybe we only have, we don't know all the birds that possibly could be up there, so maybe there's a...
Okay. So possible biases when you're doing this, and these are important to be aware of. So, simply your skill, right? ID skill is one. Something else.
You never know if, you think you hear one bird and then another one in different locations, but you don't know if the bird just like flew there or what. So,
real important one, and that is, I would say your study design. One of the issues involved is double counting. Anything else about study design?
Depending on how far birds are away, they might be out of the habitat. Or
okay, so something... representative... sampling. Did we do a good job? Did you get a good good sample at Colonial Point? Did we do a good job sampling at Riggsville? Well, what were our boundaries? We made a line through there, but did we really talk about exactly what is it we're trying to sample? No, we didn't. Just kind of went through there. Are we trying to say this is representative for a county? Is it representative for one particular habitat, one piece of land? So that's a problematic thing, that if this were our assignment, we'd want to go back and set some specific boundaries and then look to see that we really were sampling all the appropriate habitats. Anything else?
I find it hard to tell how many exactly that you hear if you hear more than one. Say you hear like many of one particular type of bird, or like crows or something calling in the background. It's hard to tell how many exactly there are.
Okay, so.
Or even to guess.
What would we put this under? In part, maybe you're under skill. If the more practice you had, you might get better at it. I think even better would be under study design, and what we did was we basically had at Riggsville, it's a transect with your points all along here. And you did the same thing at Colonial Point. And what happened, and I purposely did this, is that you were doing this at a tenth of a mile apart. It's too close, isn't it? Not only is it too close because we didn't set boundaries. We didn't set boundaries, so that makes it too close. It's too close anyway. A tenth of a mile, you can hear the loud calling of singing species. So that was a problem with study design. And the other thing that's problematic is that you were doing what? You were walking this line, and one of the things you worried about is you were pushing those chipping sparrows ahead, or you were, you were saying, oh man, I think that was the one we saw back there. So how do you deal with this? What we were talking about was what were point counts along a transect. How could you change this? What would you change to avoid the problem of double counting, of being too close? Okay, you could make your points further apart, number one. You can also do what about the distance you're collecting data? This is what Crystal was worried about, too. You can put what? You can put a boundary. You can say within 50 meters, within 100 meters. Now, that adds a little bit of a problem to it because, what's 50 meters? How do I know that? Well, that's where some skill comes into it. If these are points that you're going to be visiting on a regular basis, when you first set them up, you could go out and flag off what 50 meters was. Within very short order, if you're working with a distance like 50 meters or 100 meters, you're going to get a good sense of what it is. I'm going to ask Brad, because he's done a lot of point counts. What were your distances?
Well, we didn't have any. Because we were doing spot mapping.
Okay. He was doing something else that I'm going to talk about. I was thinking he was doing spot mapping. Typically, 50 meters is the distance. So that is going to help you because it's going to rein you in, and you don't have to be worried about overlapping. You don't have to be worried about, detecting something at a greater distance. The other thing that is typically done with a point count, so that you avoid pushing things from, one station to the next. Let's say out at Riggsville, that we had a specific area that we were wanting to sample. If we looked at aerial photos and we looked at the diversity of habitat, let's say there's forest here and there's a little wetland over here and farm field here, just to make it three simple habitats. You'd want to be able to sample these in proportion to what they actually occur in the environment. So if you overlay the grid over this, you could come up with, what percent is wetland, what forest, and so on. And based on that, the number of sample points that you would want from each of these. And then on your grid, which would be numbered, you could use a random numbers table or whatever method to figure out where you were going to sample. So let's say there should be two sample points in the wetland, and maybe four here, and four here. So you would randomize this, and then you would randomize the time that you visited, the order that you visited, so that you're not making a line and pushing things from one place to another, and so that you are visiting some sites earlier, and then if you come back, you switch that order so you visit them later. So there are all these little refinements that you can get into that help avoid some of these biases. You got any other ideas?
Some birds don't sing as much as others.
That's a great one. simply the behavior of the species.
And another thing is like, you know, like a red-eyed grouper, you're probably hearing the male singing. So do you count that as one bird or two birds?
Well, if you are doing a breeding season estimate, you typically would count it as two. But you know that, you know, that might not be accurate. But I told you your assignment was to find out what was here all year round. So let's go back. He said behavior of the species. Some don't sing as often. Some have very loud songs that carry tremendously. Some are soft. How about something like a nighthawk? You typically see those in the evening. How about owls? Did we sample owls? No, we didn't. There are some very secretive marsh-dwelling species that don't say much of anything. So we really have sampled here to for our convenience. We went there at a time that was convenient for us. We're dealing with species whose song we know by song and sight. We wanted this to be thorough. We'd have to go back at other times. And in fact, people have good protocol for sampling at night and sampling, you know, secretive species. So you'd have to come up with a list of what all you thought might be there and say, okay, is there anything here that I probably didn't get out there this morning, or I didn't specifically address the species there because I didn't use the right methodology. So that's good. Okay, anything else?
Well, there was one bird that we heard, like, while we were walking.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know if we were supposed to count him because he wasn't at the two.
Okay.
Like,
well, I forgot to mention that again. I said this before, but you do, on one of these point counts, you, no matter what happens in between, they are not included in the point count. If you have something unusual, you probably want to write it down just because you want to remember it. And you might include that in your report. But for the specific analyses, you're only sticking at the points, just doing the points.
But then aren't you not getting a thorough sample of the population, like, of what's there?
If, let's say there was a ball that flew over between points. Well, you know, that would be important. You certainly would write that down. If you did this sampling, let's say you did it five times during each season, and you continued it for 5 years, the bald eagle would show up again if it's an important part of the community, and probably during one of your point counts. There is nothing wrong with doing your point count census effort and collecting all the information, and later, as part of the report, adding, also in this area, we observed a bald eagle. But if you're going to approach any kind of analysis of these data in a rigorous way, you have to follow the rules. You can't say, oh, gee, I really want to put that bald eagle in there. But there are ways to incorporate it so you don't mislead whoever it is you're providing your report for. Let's see. The only two things that I would mention is also other things that may lead to bias. One is weather. If we've been out on a tremendously windy, gusty day, you wouldn't have seen what you did. And Brad's grinning back there.
Yeah, because when we went out to Bowling Point 2 years ago, it was just raining.
Yeah. So, but we did it anyway, and the number of species that they found and just the number of individuals was a lot lower. So weather's going to be important. And when you're doing these census efforts, there are rules about weather. You don't go out when it's raining or when the wind is over a certain level. Timing is important. We've already talked about it. If you want to do breeding birds, you don't do it in the dead of winter, or you don't do it in the middle of the afternoon. So timing during the day and seasonal timing. If you want a broad picture of what's there throughout the year, you've got to sample at different times, not just in the summer. we would have been better off if we would have done this exercise when you first got here, but of course you didn't have the skills. So that's why we waited. And then another factor is habitat conditions. There are some situations where the people out of Riggsville could see a lot further. They could see better, may have been able to hear better than those at Colonial Point, where you've got the vegetation's blocking your vision. So some habitats are easier to sample in than others.
For the habitat conditions, well, there was like a chainsaw going on in the background
right,
during
okay.
a couple of our points. So I think that made a difference too.
Good. That's a real good point. What else is going on at a particular site? You may not necessarily be in a full wilderness condition. One thing that I was concerned about, I've never had this happen before, was a guy that drove down the road. And he may have caused birds to disperse. I don't know. He may have pushed things in front of them. So there was you put that with a chainsaw and you had a couple of things that might have made you concerned. Okay. I'm going to hand out, this is, you know how I always hand out these kind of little lecture guides. I held off handing it out because I had the biases written down here at the bottom. So I've already talked about a few things here, but let's see. Send that right. Okay, so I'll just wait till you get these. Are they still circulating? That's weird. He's going to give me one.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I probably can't do this one. Okay, so we've talked about why census, what questions are asked. We also talked about, down there at the bottom, problems leading to bias. And then where it says large-scale counting techniques, I mentioned the breeding bird survey. I'm going to talk about a couple of other those surveys in a minute. Okay, I want to review and just talk about the different possibilities under the area intensive sampling techniques. I talked about the transect count. That's what we did today. You can do a point count on a transect. So you can make the points like we did and follow. A transect simply means a route that you're going to walk. Or you can do basically like what we do on a field trip. We just walk along a route. And I use a pretty similar route each year. It depends on the weather and you know what we see and so on. It may be longer or shorter. But for each site that I visit. And we don't have a point count, but we're recording everything that we see and hear along there. So that also gives you a good measure of what's in an area. It is not as precise as a point count, because a point count, you've got rules. You've got specific points, you're staying at a site for a specific length of time, you've got a distance, a framework within which you're sampling, so that from 1 year to the next, you can go back and say, well, or one sample to the next, you know, I did this the same this time as I did last time. Whereas on a field trip, if I were to put about five checklists in front of me, you know, sometimes you've got a good place and you stay there longer than at another. So there are a lot of different biases just using the Texas data, but still over a long time period, they're pretty representative. So the transect count can or cannot have a point that you operate from. Then I mentioned to you about the point counts that are very rigidly set up. This is the typical methodology for people who, if you got hired, you would typically be doing point counts, or in a minute we'll talk about the spot mapping that Brad has had experience with. And in a point count, you're typically looking at multiple species. You're wanting to know what all is there, and you randomize your the habitat, so you get good habitat coverage. And it's for a fixed time period. And in some studies, the goal may be to cover as big an area as possible, and you may only visit those points once or twice a season. Or if you want better coverage of a smaller area, you could go back 10 times. The general procedure now tends to be fewer visits to many sites. So there are large-scale projects going on, funded by a lot of sources, like Fish and Wildlife Service, Forest Service in particular, where there are entire national forests. We're talking about thousands of acres that people are doing censusing in. They have huge teams of people, and they've randomized their points, and people go out to these maybe just a couple times during the season. But they have hundreds of points that they visit throughout a particular season, and then do this over, you know, several years.
So are transect counts a type of point count, or not necessarily?
Well, a transect count simply means walking a route. I superimposed a point count on top of it so that you would see those two methods. If you were doing a study that you wanted to publish in a high-quality journal, you would do the point count, the randomized point count. I think you'd be highly criticized if you were walking a transect and doing a point count on it. The spot mapping, Brad, can I put you on the spot?
Yeah.
And have you tell them, first of all, I think, let me just preface this by saying, you know, Brad was in the class a couple of years ago. He came into the class having an interest in birds, so he was above average birder. He was good when he came. But he developed his skills in the class and continued to develop them through his interests. And then following summer, you can tell them what the job was. Tell them how many people were involved and just, you know, kind of what your assignment was.
Missouri Ozark Forest Ecosystem Project is the title of this. The whole research project, and it's not just birds. It got started as a bird research project, but there are people also studying plants, invertebrates, reptiles, you name it. It's a huge project. Just doing the birding part of it, I lived with a dozen people working on that at one location. There was also another location 45 minutes away with another, I think, 15 people there. There were 27 of us all together doing this project. So it's a large effort. And we would go out to a plot every day, and it just one of the plots, I remember they had, it's actually a subplot. It was shaped something like this, and then it was divided up, you know, something like this. And they each had a number, you know, there were 1, 2, 3, and they were given a random order so that we weren't visiting, you know, every plot, say, you know, every 3 days or every 4 days. And we also had to make sure that when we divided up who was going to these plots, that somebody didn't do a plot more than 3 times, because we didn't want to put too much bias into it by having one person go there Maybe that one person can't hear, you know, a pine warbler very well, or one of the other focal species that, that they were looking for. And, you know, there were lines that were painted on the trees, and intersections were marked with flagging. So we had a, and I can show everybody what I'm talking about this afternoon. I have some of the stuff with me. We would take out in the field a map of the whole plot and then one of the subplots that we were going to that day, and maybe one for each adjacent plot, so that if we got a little off course, we could get back on to where you were supposed to be. But basically, you had a piece of 8.5 by 11 paper, and it had, you know, the north-south lines, but it also had topographic lines that you could figure out where you were going and from where you were positioned, where a bird was singing or where you saw that bird. And you'd simply mark on there with different ways of marking it. You would circle the four-letter abbreviation for each bird that we used, that the American Ornithological Union has come up with. And, you know, to avoid double counting the birds, you would take and walk around the whole plot. But you didn't want to double over someplace that you'd already been, so you'd wander around the plot. There were nice ridges and trails that you could walk on occasionally, but you didn't want to turn around and walk back on that trail. And if you did, you definitely didn't want to write down the birds that you heard, unless it was something that you had not heard going through there before, because it may have been a bird that you counted, it was just simply on the other side of the ridge. So it's moving now, you've counted it as two birds, when it was actually just one, but it's moving within its territory. Each subplot was visited a minimum of 7 times over the summer to get the data that they needed. They preferred 10 times because they were using that data that we gathered each time to calculate the number of territories within a plot and within a fairly large area. And with that, they could figure out how many nests we had actually found of those territories. Sometimes we found the nest, sometimes we didn't. And that was...
But you made the assumption, if you had a territory,
we made the assumption
there was probably a nest
there. And that was one of the hard parts, was you could go back, and if you knew you were going out to a certain plot the next day, you could go back and look at the spot maps that people had done, you know, a couple days before, a week before, 2 weeks before, and get an idea for what you were going to see. They were pretty similar throughout all the areas. But you could also see where coverage was lacking. Maybe certain times people would enter the plot from the same area and take almost the same route. Well, you know, the next time you knew that you had to go in from a different direction and maybe cover a certain corner that people were missing, so that, you know, you were getting a very thorough coverage and not missing any birds, which was important for that.
Now, how were the questions that you were asking this project different than what we did this morning?
We were basically looking this morning, just, you know, taking a basic survey of what was there. This study was a brainchild, basically, of Dr. Fabor at the University of Missouri in Columbia, and an employee of the Missouri Department of Conservation who wanted to look at habitat fragmentation in a largely unfragmented habitat. A lot of studies have been done on, you know, in farm country and other heavily forested areas, but nothing has really been done, you know, in an uncut area and then come in and have different logging operations done. There were plots that had large clear cuts, you know, and there was slash left all over the place. There were other plots, and the clear cuts were done to initiate an even age stand so that, you know, every tree was cut down, and then once that grew up, the trees were no older than, you know, how long ago the trees had been cut. So in an uneven age stand, they had gone through and taken out circular cuts every so often. And I'm not sure exactly how they determined size of these cuts. They were determined by the foresters. But they used the techniques that they use for foresting now. Some of it had to do with, you know, was it a north-facing slope or a south-facing slope? You know, the distance between some of the cuts in this uneven age stand were a little bit different. But it's very similar to, you know, how they're cutting in other parts of the state right now. So that's what they did. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, a birder said, okay, let's cut here, let's cut there. That part of the project was given to foresters to determine, and, you know, we had to deal with that. And then there were other parts, control plots, where no cutting was done at all. And they were arranged differently. In some spots, a clear-cut area was next to an uncut area, or it was next to an uneven age stand. And, you know, that's something else to consider, is what habitat is next to, you know, the habitat you're working in.
Yeah, my question just relates to that. Like, how big were the plots, and then, you know, when you set them out in the grid, where their size, would you take into consideration what had been cut, what hadn't, you know, where you attach and when you didn't?
What do you mean?
Oh, well, the first question is, like, how big was were the plots themselves in, like, each grid section? How large an area was
I'm not sure the area of the subplot. I mean, I know the plots themselves were large. And
were they all consistent in size?
They were pretty close.
Yeah, did you just put a grid down on top of it?
Yeah. The north, south, and east, west grid lines were 100 meters apart.
Okay.
So, I mean, I could go back and, you know, look at a spot map and figure out approximately how much area there was there. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
Right now.
And then were you saying that the subplots within the plot,
mm-hmm,
then that you took into consideration?
Now, the plots, they weren't square. They tended to, the boundaries of them, like I had this drawn here earlier. This boundary here followed the edge of a wildlife reserve that we were living at. This, the whole plot was in a national forest, a chunk of national forest, Mark Twain National Forest. This boundary along here happened to follow along an intermittent creek. And they did that because they didn't want to have, you know, they wanted a representative sample of the habitat that was there. They didn't want something coming down, you know, like this with the draw here and an upland area over here, upland area here, and upland area here, and having that comprise too much of the plot. Part of it was also politics too, I imagine, with, you know, how much you could cut for this study. But the National Forest we were working in down there, it's a good chunk. There are 6 units of it, and we were only working in a small part of it.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah.
I think you got the sense of what the method that Brad was involved in is a much more detailed method. So there were other questions that that you would have access to answering. Things about density. The focus in this study was on breeding birds. He didn't say it, but I'm assuming that he wouldn't have loons down there, but let's say loons flew over the plot, that's not even, that wouldn't even be of interest to what they're doing. So instead of trying to get an overall survey, you ended up probably focusing on what, maybe 30 species, 20 species?
Yeah, probably closer to 20.
Yeah. And getting much greater in-depth information. So the spot mapping is another technique, but it's used for different purposes. Okay, if we come down to the total count, that is possible to do under a number of different circumstances, and that's what we do with the plovers. The numbers are so small, about 25 pairs of piping plovers in the Great Lakes region, that we try to get a total count. And we do that by visiting historic sites. We know what the habitat requirements are, and we have done this every year. Does that mean that we get a total count? Well, we know from for a number of reasons that that's not the case. There are places we can't get to frequently. They nest on some of the outer islands in the Great Lakes. There are probably some sites that we don't know about. But we do a pretty good job. We feel confident we do. So that's a total count example. Another total count example is you've seen enough of colonial water birds to know they're concentrated in one area. That's what we tried to do with the black terns. Our methodology was, in a sense, like a transect. You know, we moved through and counted everything that we found. We weren't depending on vocalizations. We didn't do any kind of spot mapping or spot or point counts. We just walked through an area and tried to get a total count. You can do this for, you know, other species of colonial nesting birds that are all clumped together. So often for endangered species are those that are where the numbers are very small or where you've got colonial birds that are all together. For instance, a cliff swallow colony, you could easily get a total count. You can also use that method. For most species, however, if you're going to do something with their numbers during the breeding season or otherwise, you'll have to depend on some other randomized type of sampling that's represented.
So total counts is usually just for a single species, not like a small habitat?
Right. A single species, although an exception would be a lot of colonial water birds nest where there are other species. There might be three or four other species. So while you're there, you may be doing total counts. Then finally, this other method, there are a lot of different kinds of methods that are basically specialized for species that are challenging for one reason or another. Often, people do nest counts of, say, bald eagles. In a sense, it's a total count, but since eagles are spread very widely throughout forested regions, it's a sample of a forest that might be covered. Typically, the national forests will fly and count their eagles. And the nests are up in the tops of the trees. Historically, they use the same sites. Someone who's been doing this a lot has a pretty good chance of recognizing new sites and so on. Osprey is another one that's elevated high. You can see it from the air. So an example of a sample that you can be doing from the air. It's not really it's not a point count, it's not a transect, it's probably a subdivision of a total count. You'd get the count and then you'd extrapolate that on the rest of the region or similar habitat. And then I also alluded to sampling with vocalizations. One way to sample for owls is essentially you could do the point count. You could randomize your habitat, go to points at night, play a playback, and listen for owls. Do that in a wetland for marsh nesting birds. So these different subdivisions of methodology. Now, I'm going to say just a couple of things about these large-scale counting techniques, but when I'm ending here talking about the sampling methods, what I've given you today is just an overview of the methodology used. If you're working for somebody else, if you're a grad student setting up your own program, you really want to investigate the approach that you want to take, because it's got to be comparable. And it has to be something that's acceptable to other people if it's going to be used in any kind of a useful way. And if you're working for someone else, they're going to lay it out and say, these are the rules, this is what you do. If you're given an assignment, say you're hired by a state park, or if you're a grad student and you want to incorporate some kind of sampling methods, you need to do a number of things. You need to get into the literature and see what people are doing, what methods they're using. And you need to talk to other people who are working on similar problems, or say if you're in one state park, then you find out what's been done in other state parks. So it's not something you just jump into and, you know, pick up a book and say, oh, I think I'll do this. Because there's been a tremendous amount of time and energy that's gone into developing the methodology. And once you choose something, you can standardize or you can modify it a bit to suit your own needs. But I can't overemphasize the importance of choosing a method that is going to be accepted by the larger community of people that you may be communicating with. Before we break for lunch, I want to mention two other large-scale counting techniques or programs that you need to know about. I mentioned the breeding bird survey. Any of you could be involved in a breeding bird survey. You could contact a local Audubon group. Could contact the DNR, state DNR, and say, hey, I'd like to be involved in one of these breeding bird surveys. And I'll be delighted to give you your own route, which you could follow until you die every year. Some people do these routes over and over and over again, and it's on one day. Well, you choose a day in a particular time period in June and follow this route and just are recording again what you see and hear. Two other things that I wanted to mention. There's something called a Christmas bird count that was started by National Audubon Society at the turn of the century, and it came from the fact that people in the East Coast, a lot of people went out right before Christmas for a Christmas hunt to, you know, bring game to the table. And there were individuals who were interested in bird conservation back at the turn of the century who said, well, why don't we do a count instead of a hunt? So it was a small group of people, probably fairly well. And over time, it has grown to be a national effort. So there are literally hundreds of chapters, of state chapters and local chapters of National Audubon, who go out during a particular two-week period, the end of December. Most of the counts, I think, are done around like the 15th, 16th of December, because, you know, the holidays come in there and people get distracted. But it's a group of people that go out to a specific area. They subdivide the area. It's a big social occasion, very competitive in some places. People have a great time. And they go out, and you would have your particular area that you would cover. You don't have a... You're not doing any spot mapping, you're not doing any point counts, you're not doing any transects, you're just going out and recording everything that you see and hear. And there may be, some of these Christmas count groups may have 100 people. Some of them may have one. You know, it varies. And people go out, and let's say you have more than one. Typically at the end of the day, it's a 24-hour period. You come back, assemble at somebody's house, and you have a potluck, and you go through the list and you figure out what all you saw and heard, and whether you did better or worse than last year, whether you had a new species. It's a highly social thing. Then all the information gets sent into National Audubon and gets collated. And that, all of those data are available to anybody for any particular reason. And probably the most significant product is one that was done by somebody who you've had class from, or you will, and that's Terry Root at in the School of Natural Resources in Ann Arbor. And she actually used the Christmas count data to look at wintering patterns of birds. And no one had really done this before. They'd done kind of isolated studies, but she did a continent-wide study. Now, there's some limitations. This is only done in the United States, which is frustrating, because we don't we don't know what the distribution of a lot of bird species are once they, those that are migrants that are leaving the U.S. But this is a wonderful product, and it has individual maps for all the species, and they, it also shows density patterns for observations and so on. So I'll put this in the other room so you can take a look at it. And she also related this to climate data. So this was the first product that was produced that really had good information on wintering behavior and distribution of all the species in North America based on the Christmas count data. So this is a is an essentially an atlas, it's called, of wintering North American birds. So this is a great resource to know about. If you happen to be studying any particular species, doing a report for class, take a look at this because it's got great info. And that came from Christmas count. How did I do this? I grabbed the wrong book. Anyway, I'll bring the right one up. But there's a book that looks a lot like this. Very much like this one, as a matter of fact, in the library. And it's the Atlas of Michigan Breeding Birds. And it was put together from the Breeding Bird Survey data, just from Michigan. And every single species in the state, breeding species, has a map. And it also has a page just devoted to basic biology, population trends, habitat, so on. So it's a wonderful resource. And what I want to do is open up the Merlin page so you can see it. But since I got the wrong book, I can't do that. But it's based on a large survey effort. And they're able to talk about trend patterns and also using mapping technology to actually mark where breeding has been documented. So it's a very, very useful book. Birders have been, and professional ornithologists, have been recording their observations for years, back into the 1800s, late 1800s. There are a lot of good documents. And over time, of course, things have become more and more sophisticated. And now, fortunately, we're at a point where we can produce products that are really large scale and very accurate in their portrayal of huge data sets. So that's many states are going towards these atlases, and there are national efforts of atlases and so on. So these are big scale examples of how data that you might collect as an individual or just a few individuals can contribute to a much larger picture. And then, of course, the other use of these census techniques would be for general education purposes, as in a state park, or for your own research or someone else's research. Okay, it's time to go to lunch. I'm sure you have a lot of questions right now. We're going to meet actually at 1:15 in the alumni room. In air conditioned comfort. See, I'll give up to the recorders. So for you and the recorder, if you'll just get together with the group and just run down, for Colin, just what the total. Yeah, so you'd summarize for, all the common loons, summarize all the song sparrows, all the blackbird warblers, and write on the card your site, either Rickville